Hello, this is Millie Long. I'm co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology, and I'm here today with Dr. Gary Lichtenstein. Gary is professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also wears a number of other hats, including vice chief of the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology, as well as director of development and philanthropy for the division. The role he has most recently played, though, is as senior author of the new updated Crohn's disease guideline in 2025 for the ACG. And so today I've invited Gary to come and talk to us about Crohn's disease. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you, Millie. It's a pleasure to be here, and I think this will be something of distinct help for clinicians.
Well, we're so thrilled to dig into this guideline with you. First of all, I just want to say thank you for the Herculean effort it must have been to move forward with updating these guidelines, which had been about 5 years, but there's been an explosion in Crohn's disease over the past 5 years. Do you want to just briefly talk us through the process of getting to this amazing document?
Well, first of all, it's not a single person effort. It's many individuals, and all of the co-authors put a large effort into this, as well the reviewers that have really taken the time to review this from the society as well. So it's many people putting on their hats and focusing on what's relevant clinically, what's important for clinical practice, and how do we best serve our patients with things directly. So the guidelines are established to truly give some guidance, as one would anticipate from the name. And there's some new things that have come about with these guidelines as a consequence of reviewing the literature and truly putting this together. We have new therapies that have come about. So the question is, how do we incorporate these into our clinical practice? Some of these would be risankizumab, mirikizumab, guselkumab. Ustekinumab has been there before, but some comparative studies were done. Upadacitinib as well is new. Subcutaneous vedolizumab, we had vedolizumab prior, but now subcutaneously. And then subcutaneous infliximab has as well come about. And these are our newest agents we have. And the question is, how do you effectively use them, and in what clinical scenarios is the best data there? So these are things that we touched upon as well. We touched upon how to treat patients. In other words, patients that have mild disease may not need any treatment whatsoever, just close observation and follow-up, whereas those that have virulent disease or a risk for a poor prognosis, for example, those with young age, initial extensive disease involvement, ileocolonic disease initially, perianal disease at diagnosis, extraintestinal manifestations at diagnosis, or penetrating or stenotic disease phenotype will have more aggressive disease. And we want to treat them appropriately for the disease course to be stopped and not permit them to need surgery if possible.
Such a huge endeavor. Just those few highlights you've given certainly are going to be incredibly useful for our clinical practitioners who are not only listening to this podcast, but also hopefully have already downloaded the guideline. I do want to remind our listeners that all ACG guidelines are available free of charge on the GI.org website, and that just in this most recent issue of the American Journal of Gastroenterology, the Crohn's disease guideline was highlighted with a really nice visual summary. It's also available online, something that's practical that people can put out in their offices. So, Gary, as we pointed people to the tools, but I want to verbally give them some great advice. Talk me through a couple of specifics in regards to things that have changed since the last guideline and things that our listeners could potentially do differently in clinic tomorrow after they hear this podcast.
So we'll talk about first the subcutaneous administration. And many times we realize that patients truly would prefer not to go to their practitioner's office to get infusions or to get home infusions or have difficult intravenous access. So the development of subcutaneous administration of infliximab and vedolizumab, once individuals have achieved their initial induction doses, are very exciting. So it enables people to have some freedom from going and traveling to an office or having the IV infusion at home. And those are nice things for patients. Quality of life is critical in what we do. And if we can improve the quality of life of patients, I think these are beneficial.
And, there's some data about some differences in levels, particularly for infliximab with the sub-Q as compared to the IV. Were you able to gain any insights into that? Who are the best patients to switch to this? How do we monitor? What is the role of immunogenicity? Do we have much data therein?
So the data is evolving, and the levels seem to be higher for sub-Q when administered, quote, in equivalence, both for infliximab and vedolizumab as well. If you look at the overall data, it seems as though it's more for every 6 weeks modeling as opposed to every 8 weeks when you look at the vedolizumab data. So we can achieve perhaps higher levels. The question is, does this convert long-term into differences in clinical care? And that has yet to be discerned. But levels we believe are important, but it's not necessarily an absolute level, is converted into data that says this is going to make the patient have a good prognosis. We know antibodies are bad, though.
Right. No, exactly. But it's nice to have another option, as you mentioned, and certainly would use it in the same fashion as one might use infliximab in terms of patient, infliximab IV in terms of patient selection. And really, in my practice, I've felt that any patient, any new initiator, or frankly, someone who is on maintenance dosing and stable has the potential to be switched if they feel like that's something they're interested in. Are you doing similarly in your practice?
Agree. You know, it's a shared decision-making we make with patients. There are some patients that don't want to inject themselves, and they have phobias. So in that population, it's perhaps better to enable them to get the IV as opposed to the sub-Q. So I think, you know, we always talk to the patient, ask them what they want and what their needs are, but also we look at insurance. Are they insured better to some degree as well? And that enters in the equation. We don't want to admit that, but it's part of what we do on a clinical basis daily.
Oh, absolutely. Access is huge, and that's really a major component of what we do. You know, one of the statements that I think will potentially make the greatest impact in terms of the management of Crohn's disease is a more strategic statement that the group came up with, which is, we suggest against requiring failure of conventional therapy before initiation of advanced therapy for the management of Crohn's disease. And so essentially, talk us through this statement and the evidence behind it, because I feel like this will be really helpful for us in our practice to be able to say, this patient shouldn't have to fail azathioprine or mesalamine or steroids or other conventional therapy before getting access to the biologics we need.
So it's a critical statement because it's truly, it's made our practice much more patient-focused as opposed to saying you need to fail a drug. In the past, we had a pyramid. Pyramid was you'd start with the least effective agents, and then one would then move up the pyramid over time. You fail, say, an anti-metabolite, your next step would be to consider a biologic and hence go up and up the scale. And as a result, patients would lose time. Disease would progress. As a disease progressed, complications would ensue. And in Crohn's, we see strictures developing that are fibrotic, fistula developing, abscesses coming about, and even severe disease, you know, we potentially think is a factor associated with malignancy. So having more severe disease, though it hasn't been shown that endoscopic healing leads to less cancer, we believe that that's likely scenario in individual patients. So in an effort to serve patients better, and based on data from clinical trials, we can now say that you don't need to do that. If a patient presents with perianal disease, has fistulizing Crohn's, has a good amount of their bowel inflamed or ileocolonic right at the anastomosis of the hookup of the ileum and the colon, where the ileum tends to be the highest probability of needing surgery over time, then the old saying is that punishment has to fit the crime. So you need to appropriately treat the patient with aggressive therapy in an effort to try to get mucosal healing. And we realize mucosal healing is something that lessens post-treatment likelihood of surgery or complications. So this is now the standard of practice in the United States and around the world.
I would agree. And I just hope these guidelines will help our practitioners be able to get access to these important therapies earlier. You know, in the literature, when reviewing this, the PROFILE trial in the UK was able to enroll patients within 2 weeks of diagnosis and get them on advanced therapies as compared to a more conventional step-up approach. And the differences, even at a year, were astounding. The idea of this early treatment and not requiring that step-up approach, I think, will dramatically change the lives of our patients. So it becomes really important to be able to get access, as we were just talking about, access to those therapies.
Agreed. I think that what we have to do is to look at the areas that are unmet needs. as we've done, and look at clinical trials and see if these trials can help us meet these endpoints directly to answer the questions. And I praise many of industry that have spent a lot of effort in doing this, the societies, the Crohn's Colitis Foundation, the ACG, the AGA, all have really had research set aside to enable people to answer these questions.
You know, I agree, and I think we've come so far, but we're not all the way where we need to be. And so that's what becomes so important about future studies. One other area that I wanted to highlight is that the author group did a very nice job of kind of having some specific recommendations surrounding the post-op patient. Would you mind talking us through some of those strategies for management? Just because I feel like our listeners, myself and my practice, a lot of patients still require surgery, and it really is an important time, particularly in that first year after surgery, to try to help to prevent a recurrence.
It's a great point, Millie. I think that patients already that have had surgery have a higher risk of reoccurrence. And this is a high-risk group of patients, so in an effort to better treat them, we set aside several recommendations in the guidelines, 5 in total in particular that we stated. And the first thing is when someone has had resection, and let's use ileocecal resection as an example, this is where the most data is, they should have postoperative endoscopic assessment 6 to 12 months after over no monitoring, which is what we recommend, because one can then see, is there disease that has recurred? And this goes back to the data that Paul Rutgers initially suggested years ago. And we have the Rutgers classification of the severity of disease that has recurred. And this enables us to say, what will the prognosis be? If there's a few aphthous ulcer, the overall prognosis is better at 6 to 12 months than if there's many or if there's stenosis. The other thing is those that have low postoperative risk of recurrence, we don't suggest medical therapy. We suggest continued observation and monitoring. So bring those patients back 6 to 12 months out, and if there's not anything that has recurred, perhaps in a year to check and see. But not only endoscopically, we recommend using biochemical parameters, in other words, biomarkers. Fecal calprotectin is truly very helpful and does go up based on data from clinical trials we have, or the CRP, the non-cardiac CRP is a good monitor as well that goes up in a subpopulation of patients. So these can be looked at and, of course, look for patient symptoms in addition to the findings. The other thing is we do suggest imidazole antibiotics, for example, metronidazole at doses of 1 and 2 grams after resection in patients with Crohn's to prevent recurrence. This is a conditional recommendation with low level of evidence, but it is something that you have to realize, of course, that many people don't tolerate. Mm-hmm. So good medicine works well, but the nausea, the dysesthesias, and a host of other side effects often don't permit people to take these full time. And then in patients that do have high risk Crohn's recurrence, some of the best data is the anti-TNF agents to prevent post-op recurrence. And we certainly recommend that strong recommendation, moderate level of evidence based upon the trials that have been done. And then in addition, we have recent evidence with vedolizumab in patients with high-risk Crohn's disease. We recommend vedolizumab to prevent post-operative recurrence, a conditional recommendation, low level of evidence. So the key is we have several agents available that have been shown in clinical trials. Other agents have been used as well, but the level of evidence is not to the same amount that we have for the treatment postoperatively. So this really helps the patients that have the high risk, have already gone through surgery, to lessen their potential for future surgery again.
No, I think incredibly helpful, and it goes to show how the data have really expanded. We now have clinical trials of other agents, such as vedolizumab and the treatment of postoperative Crohn's disease. I think it speaks to the same idea we were speaking of earlier, though, that earlier treatment improves outcomes. You kind of have reset things with a surgery such that applying early biologic therapy to help to prevent recurrence may actually improve the need for a subsequent surgery down the road. So really helpful. You know, Gary, this I know that this was a huge effort for our listeners. There are 35 graded statements and 59 key concepts from our expert authors of this Crohn's disease guideline. I think you will find it an incredible resource for management of your patients on a daily basis. And Gary, you and I could probably talk about this for another hour, but I think it's time to direct our listeners to the amazing resource that is the guideline document available to them at their fingertips. Thank you for all of your efforts in helping the ACG to make a difference for patients with Crohn's.
I appreciate the opportunity to do so. And I believe the guidelines process is difficult to do if you're involved with it. And it's truly an objective approach to looking at data. One may think the data is very good in an area, but when you carefully examine it, we realize it's often not as good as we believe when you look at the construct of the trials and how things are done. And this is where the evidence basis and the GRADE criteria is critical. It's an unbiased approach in an effort to better serve patients. So this is a task that is critical, and the ACG has done a beautiful job in doing this because it is clinically relevant and focused on patient care.
Great. And thank you, Gary. And again, to our listeners, please go to gi.org and download your copy of the Crohn's disease guidelines. In addition, just to emphasize to our listeners, just in the span of the last 2 months in Red Journal, we had Crohn's disease guidelines, ulcerative colitis guidelines, and preventive care and IBD guidelines. So please listen to those other podcasts as well. Lots of IBD knowledge that the ACG has put forth just in the last couple months. Thanks again, Gary, for joining me on this podcast. We so appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, and hopefully this is educational for those listening.